Welcome to the Pete Krill Podcast. I'm Daniel Sumption of Pete Krill Press, and today I have a very special guest, Terry Howard. For over 60 years, Terry has been leading rambles through Sheffield and the Peak District, inspiring generations of walkers to explore these wild and historic landscapes. But he's not just a guide, he's also a lifelong campaigner for public access to the countryside. Terry's dedication to getting access to the private moorlands around Sheffield was instrumental in leading to the 2000 Countryside and Rights of Way Act, which opened up vast areas of England and Wales to the public to roam for the first time in centuries. In this interview, we discuss Terry's decades of walking and activism, the inspiration behind his work, and his 1992 book, A Moorland Notebook, a key part of the campaign for countryside access, which is now being crowdfunded for a new edition by Terry and Peakrill Press. Links to the crowdfunding campaign and to Terry's earlier book, An Inner City Round Walk of Sheffield, can be found in the show notes at audio.peakrill.com. Now, on with the interview. Hello, Terry.
Right, hello there.
I'll start saying a bit about how we know each other. I realised that I first met you 40 years ago this year.
Yeah.
I was 16 and you took me and a load of my mates up on a mountain in Wales.
That's right, I remember it clearly.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And yeah. We all slept on top of the mountain in bivvy bags. I think was it raining as well?
There were one walk that does come to mind. It was near Trefan, where the weather turned absolutely vile. And we had to sleep out that night.
Yeah.
And there were one rock, a bit of a lean-to. So we got everyone bedded down for the night, you know, and it were a terrible night. Anyway, fortunately, the following day was much clearer. Then we continued with the walk. We're heading for Trefan. There we met another group. Some people walked down with other group back to the bottom of the mountain, whereas a few of us continued up onto Trefan. So we conquered that.
Yeah.
And then we went down and back to camp.
Yeah. And then, I ended up marrying your daughter after that. So you're my father-in-law, but actually I met you before I met her.
Yeah.
A couple of years before.
Yeah.
And you've been kind of leading walks pretty much most of your life, I think, haven't you?
Well, yeah, from being a kid in the woodcraft folk, for whatever reason, I was trusted at 15 year old to take kids over the moors.
Right.
Which I did do. Fortunately, I did have map reading skills that my dad taught me. I remember sitting on the carpet in front of the fire with a compass and a map. I'm going through procedures and all like that.
Yeah.
And it stuck.
You didn't lose any kids on the way?
I've never, ever lost anybody. The only one anecdotal thing that happened, and it wasn't all that long ago. It was snowing. It was a heavy snow.
Mm.
I led a walk on very familiar ground, but because you couldn't see the paths, I had to rely on what I thought were going in the right direction. Anyway, wandered through the snow, through the blizzard, and we got to what I thought should have been the path. Anyway, the path weren't there. So I got the compass out just to check, and I'm sure my compass is wrong. Fortunately, somebody had a sat-nav.
Yeah.
And they confirmed that the north, which I wanted, were opposite way that we were going. So it was just a simple matter of turning around, retracing steps, only for a few metres.
Mm.
And we were okay, you know. But it's simple things like that that can throw you.
Yeah, I think people don't realise how dangerous it can be if you...
Oh, absolutely. If it weren't for this person with the sat-nav, I may have continued going the wrong way.
Yeah.
But anyway, that I'm not advocating sat-navs. A good compass, you can't beat it. But you've got to trust it.
Yeah.
And you've also been really involved in the campaigning for access, the right to roam and access to the countryside for pretty much all your life as well, haven't you?
Well, again, as a kid, I remember, only a small kid, I remember my dad taking me and my brother onto Warncliffe Chase. Now, at that time, it was private keep-off. Anyway, we saw something in distance on this moor that we wanted to have a look at. So we climbed up a wall. We actually crept through all undergrowth just to see what this thing was. And it was a notice. And it said, private, keep off. You know, a bit late. But, so it was from then on, I thought, you know, this is not right. This was not long after Second World War as well, early 50s. And, you know, to think that my dad fought for the freedom in this country, and on his return, within a few years, he was told he couldn't go on the land that he was fighting for. So, you know, that galled on me, and it still does to this day. So that's how I got into it. But I've always had this urge, you know, what's that in the distance? Must go and have a look. And more often than not, it's on private moorlands. Yeah. So you were ducking and diving, going over moorlands. You didn't want to be seen by keepers. Yeah. Because some keepers were nasty pieces of work. I've been confronted a few times, but we've always left in high spirits, yeah. You know. Because I think some gamekeepers were reasonable, but they couldn't see beyond their own job, you know, keeping people off.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've never got into any real conflict situation.
You said that on some of your trespass walks, you would kind of inform the gamekeepers beforehand of where you were going.
Yeah, well, one of the best ways, I suppose, these landowners thought was, you know, forget about them, they'll go away and, you know, and we'll be back to normal again as well, you know, private moorland. Well, we weren't having that, you know, we kept on going. But to raise profile amongst the landowners themselves, we told them beforehand, we're going up more, we want to have a look at such and such a thing. Why don't you join us? They never did like, but they always came back and said, have a good walk, enjoy your walk and all like that.
Yeah.
To them, it were like giving permission, but they knew it weren't. They were just hoping that we'd go away. Mm. Well, we didn't go away. We kept on going. In fact, there were one landowner who got to know quite well. He even called at his house one day and invited us in and made a cup of coffee and a chat and all like that. So some of the landowners weren't all that bad. It were more the keepers in some case. Mm. But then again, for them, it were all jobs worth.
Yeah,
that's what they had to do.
The Kinder Mass Trespass of 1932 has always been an inspiration to you, is that right?
Well, this is it. Again, at Woodcroft, as a little kid, our leader, Basil Rowson, his Woodcroft name was Brown Eagle. He always told us the story of the Kinder Trespass. And it was fascinating to hear about it and to learn and to try and understand why people couldn't actually walk on moors and walk on Kinder Scowl. At that time, you could, you know, this was 1950s. But Kinder itself was a challenge. You know, to us, it was like we'd up Mount Everest or something like that, you know. And I can remember my first day on Kinder, walking up or climbing up a waterfall to get to the top. I'd always reluctant, you know, what's on top? What's it going to be like? Anyway, we emerged on top and it was completely flat, peat, and you could see for miles. It was a fantastic experience. So I could understand why people even now still want to get onto Kinder.
And would that have been trespassing in those days?
When we did it in the 50s, no.
Right.
But before that, it was. I think it wasn't until the National Parks Act 1949 that you could legally go on, because access agreements were made you know, to go on places like Kinder Scout.
Yeah.
And, well, at that time, were National Trust land. But the private moorlands were still private, keep off barbed wire fences.
And am I right in thinking that in 1982, with the 50th anniversary of the mass trespass, things stepped up a bit with the campaigning work?
Well, yeah, it were an odd time, 1982. Somebody picked up, well, they were a member at Ramblers, who wrote in Star, at a local paper, what is Sheffield doing about the Kinder trespass, the anniversary? And two young fellas got together and organised a trespass on Bamford Moor, which is just on county boundary, Moscow. And to their surprise, and everybody else's surprise, there were something like 200 people turned out. And it showed to them and everyone else that there was still this demand for access to open country. We walked over onto Bamford Edge. We had a fantastic walk, really enjoyable. The keepers and landowner kept out of the way. In fact, they even let the gate open so we could walk through without climbing over it. They thought we'd go away, but we didn't. We agreed after to set up a group called Sheffield Campaign for Access to Moorland. And then that way, we organised trespasses every month or two on pieces of moor that you couldn't go on. But to me, just having access, for the sake of access, weren't enough. It weren't good enough. And that's why I started leading some trespass walks to places of interest that people wouldn't normally be allowed to see. So they became voyages of exploration, on these forbidden moorlands. Fortunately, now we can all visit them. And so that was how I got involved with it. And it was well worth it. I did join the Ramblers during that time. And because we were active in Sheffield, the Ramblers from London office would organise other events up and down the country. But they always came to Sheffield and all those trespassers, because we were the only group at the time that would, you know, step out of line and support these campaigns. So we became the foot soldiers, if you like, of the Access campaign in the early 80s.
And then, and did that feed directly into getting more access in the
2000s? Oh, absolutely, because the person that Ramblers employed, he started lobbying the Labour MPs, and he got quite a lot of support from several of them, who in turn would lobby in Parliament. And it was when Tony Blair became Prime Minister, again, the lobbying continued. And it was once said, I don't know how true it is, but they reckon Prescott, you know, the
Deputy Prime Minister,
Prime Minister, actually did influence Tony Blair. Many Labour MPs supported it, and one of them put a private member's bill in that got its third reading. But I can remember on the day in the year 2000.
This is the Countryside and Rights of Way Act.
Yeah, when a group of us went up onto Moors at Mid-Hope with transistor radios. It was the day of the Queen's speech in November. And we just stood there, well, all transistor radios came out and listening to Queen's speech. She said, my government will create a right to roam and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That were it. You know, rucksacks open, yeah. Champagne came out, and they were celebrating up Moors Mid-Hope.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, they were a very special moment, that.
It's very different up there now in that you can roam across a lot of those moors.
Well, you can do, yeah. Yeah, but success, we've seen it recently, that success is bringing a few other problems, like overuse, erosion, plus, you know, climate change and stuff like that are all adding to problems. So I know National Trust and others are doing the best to try and improve moorland as well as well, not just improve it, but get it back to like it used to be in the distant past. Mm. So interesting, but there's still a problem.
Yeah, and there's still a difference between England and Wales and Scotland, isn't there? And what
well, yeah, right yeah. Now. Well, England and Wales, you know, we've got the right to roam through Crow Act. In Scotland, I think it were a human right to wander at will, similar to that in Scandinavia. Mm. Well, we want that. We would have liked it to be the same as in Scandinavia.
Yeah.
But in many ways, the Countryside and Rights of Way Act was a compromise because within that Right to Roam Bill, conservation were also added to it to get it through Parliament, which is easier. Well, we've got everything, but not quite everything. There are still places of access that could have been included in the Right to Roam. Access to all woodland, mature woodland. There are still pockets of moorland that you can't walk on. You know, it's still private. Anyway, we keep trying, but I think really it's up to younger people to try.
Yeah, yeah. In that period in the 80s and 90s when you were campaigning with Sheffield Campaign for Access to Moorland, that's when you put together your moorland notebook, which we're now updating?
Yeah, well, we're doing all these things. We're discovering all these things. To me, it was absolutely fascinating. And then, just one day, you know, seen all this, done all that. So what? What am I doing about it? And I felt I had to put pen to paper and just write it down. Because, as far as I know, there's nothing else, or there weren't anything else at the time. So we did that. Having said that, there were a rambler who started Clarion Ramblers up in 1900. He was one who did his trespassing, did his exploring, did his writing, his publishing, and it was through his publishing little booklets called Clarion Ramblers Handbooks that's absolutely jam-packed full of information from those early days, and they themselves became sources of inspiration. But I can remember shortly before he died, he made a note.
G.H.B. Ward.
Yeah, G.H.B. Ward.
Yeah.
About carrying this on. I hope somebody would carry that on.
Yeah.
Well, nobody did do at that time. And that's another reason why I wanted to contribute or do something.
Yeah. So you did carry it on eventually.
Yeah.
In, was it 1992 that book came out?
Yeah, yeah.
Say a bit about what's in it. So there's some like trespass routes in there.
Yeah, but, yeah.
But there's also kind of, you're talking about the actual history of the rights of way and the enclosures and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's just things that I felt I needed to put down and to show other people what they can see, what they can explore, what they can learn. And it's been fun, it's been exciting, but also it's been informative.
Yeah.
Even to this day, you can still go out on the moors and rediscover different things and all like that. It's not just so-called heritage, you know. Mm. You're finding out about people who lived in the past. And, well, I find it particularly interesting.
Yeah. There's also some of that that you've kind of documented being destroyed, like Told Woman's Stone at Bamford.
Yeah.
The gamekeepers have destroyed kind of markers and things like that?
It was GHB Ward who picked up on this, because the big standing stone in the middle of Bamford Moor, private moorland, but ramblers would always use that stone as a marker of going across moors.
Mm.
Now, one year it were there, following year it had gone. The holes were drilled in the bottom and it were felled.
Mm.
So, you know, an ancient way marker, which it was, an ancient standing stone.
Yeah, was it several thousand years it had been stood
yeah,
there?
Yeah, it's got to be nearly, we're talking about 5,000 years or something like that, and just within an hour or two, down.
Yeah.
But there's also been other acts of vandalism by landowners or their gamekeepers. another one, or Moscow Cross.
Yeah, you've been looking at the roadside cross, or the moorland crosses and
that's
stuff.
Right. But this one was particularly interested because you looked on the map, it's a new cross, but all private moorland. What's a cross doing it, middle of moorland? There's no obvious paths or trikes. I remember going out and looking for it and discovering it, and they were part of shaft, they were a wayside cross. It might have been on an ancient burial road, it probably would have been. And there were a big piece of shaft stuck in top. Anyway, following week or week after, you'd look across moors and that shaft's gone. So you'd go over it more, you'd find it and you'd put it back in. And this went on for a year or two. Ramblers were putting shaft back, gamekeepers were taking it down. And one year later, I went up to put the shaft back and it had gone. Now, it were a big piece of stone. There's no rambler going to stick that in the rucksack and take it home. It had to be taken away with one of these little buggy things. Anyway, a small stone were put in its place, you know. Mm-hmm. And on that cross was, it looked like a sword carved into the bottom. Or was it another cross? We don't know. But there's still questions to be asked and to find out about on the moors with things like that, you know.
Yeah, and aren't you writing another book about that at the moment?
We've gone through all crosses, wayside crosses, probably like burial roads in around Ecclesfield, Sheffield and Bradfield. All that area was known as Alamshire. Mm. So it's all those crosses in that area. But there's only a handful left.
Yeah.
Because they're all damaged and vandalised during Reformation.
Mm. So how long back would those crosses go?
Who knows? It could be pre-conquest.
Right, so over 1,000 years.
Yeah, could be pre-conquest. You know, Catholic Church were adopted, the early English Church adopted Catholic ways, you know, in early days from some 8th century, something like that.
And they were marking out burial routes where they carry the coffin across.
That's what we believe, although it's not properly recorded in this area. You'll find in Cornwall, North Yorkshire, Lake District, they are marked as burial roads, you know. But what we have got, what we're starting to find, you've got names of roads called Bury Lane or Burying Lane, you know, and things like that, which were corpse ways.
Yeah.
And then you've got the Lich Gate, which means the way into the churchyard where a body were carried. So they had to be, you know, burial roads. They had to be.
Yeah. And you're doing a lot of original research on this.
Well, I believe it is original research. Many writers in the past have mentioned wayside crosses. They don't go into detail on burial roads, although this suggests they may have been. But some of them are claiming that all these crosses were marking boundaries. But research that we've done, the majority of crosses are not on boundaries. Yeah. They're on the side of old trackways. So that suggests quite strongly that they were a religious way and it would have been a burial road.
So you've got a book forthcoming on that at some point.
Hopefully we're going to, we've got most of the text done.
Yeah, you're writing that with someone else, that right?
Yeah, it's a joint book to myself and a chap called Nick, he's also dead keen on it. You know?
Yeah. You say you've been writing that for like 40 odd years now.
You know, it must be 40 years ago.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I kept collecting information and building it up and all like that. But when I met Nick just over a year ago, that we discovered common ground, and he were keen on producing something. So
yeah. And we're also putting together a new edition of your Moorland Notebook, which, like I say, well, at the time was kind of all about trespass routes and places you couldn't go to.
Yeah.
So why kind of revisit that now, 33 years later?
Well, we've moved on. things have changed. And again, I think, try and put it more in context of today. It's what you feel now, how things are now, but in particular, not forgetting the past.
Yeah.
And it's almost word for word as they were originally written, but more up to date.
It's a modern context. Yeah. You talked about G.H.B. Ward wanting to kind of pass the baton on, and I think you've been the one who's picked it up. You think it's time to sort of find a younger generation to...
Well, hopefully,
inspire them.
Yeah. I mean, the Clarion Ramblers handbooks that he wrote, there's no doubt about it, they are treasure. Mm. Even a late one, done in the 1950s, if you can find one, you can pay anything, 20-odd quid for one, a little book. If you can find one of around about 1907, you are talking about several hundred pounds. They are real collector's items and all original work that we can still draw on. Yeah. Archaeologists nowadays are still using his researchers. Mm. So, you know, they were that good.
And a couple of years ago, we worked together on another of your books that you did in the 1990s, which was the Inner City Round Walk of Sheffield, which is quite a different thing. Instead of walking up on the moors, this is walking around the city centre pretty much, or the inner suburbs.
A different experience, but at the same time, the inner city round walk were taking people onto paths that you wouldn't normally walk on, and taking people into green open spaces within the city. They were little challenges and all like that, and even today when I've led them, you know, people are quite excited by them and all like that.
What I especially liked about that book as well, it's not just telling you specific things to look at, it's more prompt, it's kind of guiding people to look for themselves and to make their own route.
That's exactly it. It's get out there and look, and, you know, there's lots of things that are surprises. We did something called a weird walk a few weeks ago. I led one walk around local generals in this area. They're known as Ginnells in Leeds, but the alleyways between where I live at Crosspool, going over to Forwood and Bent's Green on all these back alleys, and which were great. Then following week, one of the women that I normally walk with, she did a similar one, but all the back alleys and channels around River Sheaf, around Maresbrook and all that. Again, fantastic, you know, and she took us on channels that were brand new and some that I never knew existed. So you can still explore and discover, you know, on your doorstep.
Yeah.
In fact, I've lived here, I don't know, 40 years nearly, and it was only a couple of years ago, less than a quarter of a mile away, I discovered a new general that I never knew existed. You know, so there's stuff there.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I've spoken to people who've done that inner city round walk many times and find new things every time, or look at things in a different way every time. And what's nice is the way it's written is deliberately to kind of inspire that.
Oh, good,
Oh, well, thanks, Terry. That's been great.
That's all right, no. My pleasure.
We're looking forward to the new edition of the Moorland Notebook.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peakrill Podcast with Terry Howard. If you've been inspired by our conversation and want to help bring a Moorland Notebook back into print, you can support the crowdfunding campaign now. You'll find a link to the Kickstarter in the show notes, and every pledge helps to make this new edition a reality. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it with fellow walkers and lovers of the great outdoors. And if you haven't already, then please do check out Terry's Inner City Round Walk of Sheffield, which is also linked in the show notes, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts or on audio.peakrill.com. See you next time, and until then, happy rambling.